in a conference is not an easy task, and it goes without saying how challenging it could be. What I would like to do in the next 10 minutes or so is to quickly run through the natural history of cervical cancer, with particular reference to how we can prevent both by vaccination as well as by early detection. And I would like to stress the fact there are two armaments at the moment, cancerous lesions and managing them properly. Prevention by vaccination is an emerging technology, I think, which is going to have tremendous impact in the future, pending technological developments that will result in much better vaccines and much affordable prices. As we all know, the natural history of any disease, the knowledge about the natural history is vital for its management, for its prevention. And among all cancers, we know the best about cervical cancer. The most well understood cancer in terms of natural history is cervical cancer, and it presents an excellent model to describe the natural history of cancer. Exposure to an etiological agent whose carcinogenic activity is potentiated by cofactors, which converts a normal cell into a clonogenic cancerous cell, which expands through a process of precancerous lesions, which stay there for a long time, which ultimately, under certain circumstances, become invasive cancers. This is the best model. The major advancement in cervical cancer prevention has been, in recent years, has been the identification that cervical cancer is a very rare outcome of a very common reproductive tract infection. The infection of the surface epithelium of the reproductive tract in men and women is ubiquitous. So most people will be affected by human papillomaviral infection at some point of time. But fortunately, the infection clears in most of the people. In few people, it persists, particularly among women. And this leads to cervical cancer in the long run. And among all these 15 types, the most virulent human papillomaviral infections are those of HPV 16 and 18. So people infected with HPV 16 has the highest possibility of remaining persistent and progressing to invasive cancer. And the infective potential or the persistent potential or the carcinogenic potential of the other types are much, 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 much lesser than HPV 16. And we would say proportionately 50 to 55% of the cervical cancers are caused by HPV 16, and about 10 to 15% are caused by HPV 18. And it is a single clonal cell. Even if people are infected with, say, like more than one human papillomaviral type, it is one of the HPV viruses which causes cancer. So if there is a multiple infection like 16, 18, 33, etc., etc., most likely which is 16 which is going to cause. In very few women only, the other types cause cervical cancer. So what is the evidence? Professor Surasan got the Nobel Prize for the discovery of HPV as the central cause for cervical cancer. But the evidence, the consistent evidence, comes from several workers who have done a large number of case series, case control studies and prospective studies. I think in the history of human carcinogenesis, no other carcinogen has given relative risks like 100, 150, 200, 300 times the risk for developing a cancer after a following persistent infection. So there is no doubt that it is caused by human papillomaviruses. And the most strongest evidence for the carcinogenesis comes from prevention studies. Now we are conclusively demonstrating using vaccination, you can prevent cervical cancer. So ultimately, the experimental evidence is also now emerging. Infected after sexual debut in their lifetime. But fortunately, in 50% of the infected women, the infection clears within 6 months. And in 80%, the infection would have cleared by 36 months. Only in 5 to 15% of the women, the infection persists. The definition of persistence is if you test a woman consecutively two times or several times for detection of HPV DNA, if there is HPV DNA in at least in two of the tests, That is the definition of persistence. And statistical terms, out of every 10,000 women infected in their lifetime, 10 women progress to developing a CIN2 or 3 lesion. And ultimately, one woman develops cervical cancer in their lifetime. So that is why it is a very rare outcome of a very common reproductive tract infection. People do not know how the latency occurs or how the infection clears by natural mechanisms. But it's an extremely interesting process. Since it is an infection of the surface epithelium, the virus rarely comes into contact with blood. So only in about 20 to 30% of the women, a natural cause the humoral immunity. And then it has very dangerous antigens within its core, the E proteins, and particularly E6 and E7, which go and knock out the retinoblastoma protein and the P16, which are the natural barriers against carcinogenesis in human cells. So that when this interaction happens, when this expression of E6 and E7 happens, then possibly the people develop precancerous lesions, the clonogenic cells, precancerous lesions and cancer. So once the integration of the HPV DNA into the human cell DNA happens, that is when the expression of the E6 and E6 proteins happen, and there are the transforming RNAs formed, the cell transformation occurs, which leads to dysplasia, which is dysplastic cells and epithelium containing dysplastic cells, which ultimately progress to cancer. And this orderly progress in most women happens over a period of, say, 20 to 25 years. So people have considerable opportunity to detect precancerous lesions by screening. And people would now say that CIN3 or severe dysplasia or carcinoma in situ, in the old WHO terminology, CIN3, WHO still uses the cervical intraepithelial neoplasia terminology. They have not switched over to the Bethesda system yet. And by the Bethesda system, the high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesions are the lesions, the adenocarcinoma in situ, the glandular lesions, the high-grade glandular lesions, which constitute the true precursor of cervical cancer. And there are various terminologies which are used. They are interchangeably used. So people should understand the exact translations between the different terminologies. The old WHO system used the dysplasia terminology. The new WHO system uses the CIN terminology, which into normal, atypia, CIN 1, 2, 3, and dysplasia, CIN 1, sort of character is characterized by the cancerous cells occupying the lower one-third of the epithelium. In CIN2 or moderate dysplasia, the dysplastic cells occupy the middle one-third of the epithelium in addition to the lower third. Whereas in severe dysplasia, CIN3 or carcinoma in situ, the entire thickness of the epithelium is involved, but the basement membrane is intact. The natural history, from infection to cancer, how it progresses. Ethically, you cannot study it directly. You cannot allow people to progress to cancer. But there are several means, several types of study designs one can use to address this issue. So people have used cross-sectional studies, cohort studies, and carefully observing screening programs in developing countries linked with cancer registries, so that what happens to people who do not receive treatment. And over time, the treatment of cervical precancerous lesions has evolved. In the 1950s and 60s, when cervical cytology was the predominant screening procedure, anybody with a cytological diagnosis of carcinoma in situ, these were the only people who were intervened with. Anybody reported to have carcinoma in situ, they will immediately go and do a surgical conization, and the tissues are studied. People with reports like moderate dysplasia, mild dysplasia, and severe dysplasia were left alone. This is the practice in 1960s and the early 70s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s. It took considerable time for people to move over to managing CIN3, CIN2, the severe dysplasias, the moderate dysplasias, and a selected number of mild dysplasias. This particularly was happening in the late 70s and at the mid-80s. And then the treatment techniques like the loop electrosurgical excision procedure, much simpler treatment techniques like cryotherapy, the laser excision procedures, the loop electrosurgical procedures, they are all evolved in the 70s and 80s. So the management moved from surgical conization to the simple technologies. So a wide spectrum of cervical neoplasia was started to be managed. So by very careful observation of this unmanaged CIN2, 3, etc., one could study what proportion of them move to progress to cancer. But you have to also identify some of the problems with these studies, like small sample sizes, varying definitions, and varying times of follow-up, and things like that. Irrespective of all these constraints, we have a wealth of information from these studies. And one of the first comprehensive look into the natural history was provided by a gynecologist from New Zealand, late Dr. Asta, who combined several studies published in literature so that you have a large sample size. It's a precursor to meta-analysis, not real meta-analysis, just pulling of studies, and then looked into the comprehensive proportions of people with the mild, moderate, and severe dysplasias who are persisting, who are regressing, and who are progressing to invasive cancer. And these were the proportions. What it shows is a large proportion of people with CIN1 regress, and a very small proportion, less than 5%, progress to higher grades of cervical dysplasia or cancer. Whereas a larger proportion of people with carcinoma, with severe dysplasia persist or progress to invasive cancer. So this is the basic philosophy emerging from this pooled studies. Some of the percentages are lower because this is a heterogeneous number of studies. Some of them are managed, some of them are inadequately managed, some of them are not managed. So it is a pooling of several studies. So that's why some of the proportions are lower. And then a second opportunity exists from British Columbia. British Columbia studies, you know, that is the place, the province in the world first to introduce cervical cytology screening as early as 1950. And then the linkage with cancer registry showed what is the proportion of people progressing to invasive cancer. One of the most recent studies comes from Toronto. Again, these are cancers. These are people with a cytological diagnosis of cervical dysplasia who were not provided with treatment, so that it gave an opportunity to study what proportion of them progressed to invasive cancer. The diagnostic validity of cytological diagnosis is much inferior to a histological diagnosis. That is the paradigm that we will maintain at this time. Several pathologists may question this, but that is the paradigm we will maintain. If you maintain, what I'm meaning to say is when a cytologist reports like CIN2 or 3, there is a 50% possibility histologically may not find a concordant lesion. So that means considering a cytological diagnosis is a much weaker valid diagnosis for disease, you have to interpret these proportions. So ultimately what it shows is the number of people with a cytological diagnosis of moderate dysplasia progressing to severe dysplasia or cancer over a 2-year period is like 16%, over a 5-year period is like 25%, and a third of them progress to such higher grades, this is in histological terms, in 10 years. And again, for progression to cancer, according to these studies, somebody with a cytological diagnosis of severe dysplasia progresses to invasive cancer. It is 1 in 5, like 20% of them have progressed in this particular study, the screening study in Toronto. These are very valid data. At the moment, we do not have a marker to say which one with a cervical precancerous lesion will progress to invasive cancer. Billions of dollars have been put into this to find out something which is very magic. Now people are looking into whether it is ultimately people expressing E6 and E7 RNA. Are they the people who are going to really progress to invasive cancer? Follow-up studies are ongoing at the moment that will clarify the situation. Are people who accumulate the P16 mutations, are these people who are going to progress? So we don't know at the moment. But there are some factors with a high risk of progression, like a persistent HPV infection, aneuploidy, persisting psychological abnormalities, and age. And I would say, at the moment, anybody from a developing country perspective, anybody with a cervical precancerous lesion, a particularly histologically diagnosed lesion above the age of 30 years, is at very high risk of progression to higher grades or invasive cancer. And that is one of the reasons in the WHO we would take a stand in many, many places, particularly in developing countries, cervical screening should not start before the age of 30 years. Whereas in developed countries, you know, in some developed countries it is like it starts at the age of 20, in some places 25. But in most of the dysplasias which will be diagnosed before the age of 30, either cytologically, histologically, are likely to regress. And for the maximum cost effectiveness, we would insist that screening starts at the age of 30. And in developing countries, it is particularly even more important. And ultimately, the dictum is to say, in a very dogmatically, 5% of the CIN1 or mild dysplasias progress to invasive cancer. 20% of CIN2 or the moderate dysplasias will progress to invasive cancer over a 15-year time. And the probability for CIN3 is 50% of people with the histological diagnosis of CIN3 will progress to invasive cancer over a period of 15 years. That means if a practitioner manages 100 women with CIN3 in her lifetime or in his lifetime, he or she has prevented 50 women going into invasive cancer, and that is a very, very dramatic development in terms of saving human lives. And particularly when you take into account cervical cancer still a problem and affects, that is probably the number one cause of death in many developing countries, including India, among women aged 30 to 59 years. And the best way to tackle the situation, because the governments are not going to organize programs in many countries, it is not simply possible for large countries like India with severe strain on financial resources. So everybody takes, every practitioner, particularly a general practitioner, takes an initiative to screen women when they come for something else, you know, like any woman above the age of 30 and below the age of 50 or 59, with whatever technique they have, whether it is cytology, practice cytology, and if you are going to a magic bullet HPV test in future, which is likely to happen, you manage them, or you have iodine and acetic acid with you, just apply and then see if there is an acetovite area which turns an yellow area with Lugol's iodine, and direct a biopsy and then immediately manage them with one of the treatment techniques like an ablative technique, cold coagulation or cryotherapy or loop excision, whatever it is, you are doing an yeoman service, especially when you are doing this for women above the age of 30 years. Thank you for your attention.